Hello, and welcome to New Books in Public Policy. I am Tevi Troy, your host. Each week, we look at a different book in the public policy arena and talk about its implications for current public policy debates. This week, we're going to be talking to Saul Stern about his book, A Century of Palestinian Rejectionism and Jew Hatred. If the title sounds a little stark, it doesn't have that standard clever title and then explanatory subtitle, it's because it's part of the Encounter Broadsides. These are a series of 8,000-word broadsides or pamphlets. They're shorter than the average book considerably, and they try and pick on one piece in public policy and try and explain on it and talk about what its meaning is for the current public policy debates. So we're going to talk to Saul Stern about the book of Palestinian Rejectionism and Jew Hatred, but also the broadsides and what they mean and what they're trying to accomplish. Saul Stern, welcome to New Books in Public Policy. Can you tell us a little bit about yourself and how you came to write this book?
Yeah, I'm a contributing editor at the City Journal, published by the Manhattan Institute. I write about American education and often about the Middle East, or more specifically the Israel-Palestinian conflict. I often joke I have the sad task of writing about the two most intractable problems. So I've done quite a bit of reporting, and I've been to the Middle East many times. My wife and I travel to Israel several times a year. I was basically asked to do this by the publisher of Encounter Books, Roger Kimball. And the idea was that there are a lot of people who have what he calls a lot of conservatives and people of very good will have a very pro-Israel and know the right positions, but they don't have the background to know exactly know what happened. You know, what's the history like? And so it was a perfect subject for the Encounter broadsides, of which there are now 20 or 22 that Encounter has published. And the idea is to, in a very short format of about 8,000 words, take on some problem, some public policy issue, and do a kind of polemic. The broadside tradition was very American, goes all the way back to Tom Paine, and that's why I did this on Palestine Israel.
The title of the broadside is very stark, A Century of Palestinian Rejectionism and Jew Hatred. There's no clever title. There's no subtitle. It's just, this is what it is. Is that typical of the broadsides, or was that your pick?
That happened to be my choice. You're exactly right, and some people sometimes joke. Not very subtle, is it? No. I chose that title because I think that's exactly what happened. And we have to, you know, actually, Nick Gilder said it at the debate the other night. Why don't we start telling the truth about the Middle East and stop beating around the bush and call it, call things as they are? And that's, in effect, what I try to prove in 8,000 words, going from the Balfour Declaration to the current period. And that's exactly what we see, that the Palestinians have been given a chance many, many times to have a state. They've rejected it. And instead, what they want, they don't even want. I don't even believe they want their own state as much as, I think they do want their own state, but they don't want their own state as much as they want to deprive the Jews of their own state. So that and it involved specifically a lot of Jew hatred, including by Palestinian leaders who were linked with the Nazis, more specifically the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem, Haji Amin al-Husseini, who led the Palestinians for over two decades in the crucial period from 25 till past the creation of the state. He was a collaborator of the Nazis and spent the war years in Berlin. He met with Hitler. He discussed the final solution with Hitler. In fact, he was the first non-German to be told about the plan for the final solution, and he believed in it. And so, I think that, to me, that justifies the title of the label Jew hatred.
It's an important term, an important question, because we just had this incident where the U.S. ambassador to Belgium claims that Muslim anti-Semitism is justified by Israeli government policies. The implication of that is it's only with the existence of the State of Israel and then the recent Israeli governments that this Islamic or Arab anti-Semitism has come into being. And your book says that that is not the case. In fact, on page 12, you have a Palestinian official saying that the Jews suck the blood of everybody. And so, I mean, this is generations ago. So can you talk a little bit about that history?
The declaration, the Balfour Declaration, yes.
Because I'd
love to send him, I'd like to send the ambassador a copy of my broadside.
I'm sure he'd love to see it. But he'd also ask for a check for the Obama administration because I believe he's a great bundler. So,
yes, that's right.
But can you talk a little bit about this? How this is a history? I mean, you know, there is a general perception out there that Jews and Arabs loved each other. Everybody was happy under the Ottoman Empire. There were no problems between Jews and Arabs and or Muslims. I recognize there's a distinction there. But only once that the State of Israel came about, then suddenly anti-Semitism came out around and therefore it's justified. I think you say that is not the case. Can you talk a little bit about it?
Well, I think even the first part of your statement was the prevalent belief out there about there was more harmony between Jews and Arabs than there was between Jews and Christians, that the Muslims had a tradition of collaboration and tolerance with Jews. Well, that's a gross exaggeration also. And you know, this is not my area of scholarship, but certainly there are serious scholars like Bernard Lewis and others who have debunked this idea and shown that, well, while it's true that nothing approached the viciousness of Christian anti-Semitism, you know, from the Middle Ages on in the Muslim world, still Jews were deprived of their basic civil rights. They were considered a dhimmi people, a subservient, like anyone who's not a Muslim. So the first part of it, that's not true. And then certainly, from the moment of when the British Mandate of Palestine was created, which gave the Jews an opportunity to immigrate to Palestine and with the goal of creating a Jewish homeland, Palestinians immediately opposed the very idea of Jewish immigration, and even though it was clear that the British, you know, by the late 20s, early 30s, were certainly not in favor of taking away the rights of the Palestinians to have a homeland of their own. That is, the British government favored a two-state solution from the 1930s on, in fact proposed after the Peel Commission met to try to decide what to do with Palestine, the Palestine Man. They proposed a two-state solution in which the Jews would have received a very tiny sliver of the area west of the Jordan River, and that sliver going from basically from where Tel Aviv is now up near the coast up through Haifa. And even then, the Palestinian leadership under Haji bin Husseini rejected it. And the other thing that people don't know is, in fact, the British created a Palestinian state. They were given, the under the League of Nations mandate, the British had control of all of the territory from the Mediterranean Sea all the way through to the east bank of the Jordan River into what is now the Kingdom of Jordan, or at that time was called the Emirate of Transjordan. And Churchill changed the mandate and cut off the section east of and created what was called the Emirate of Transjordan. In effect, and boasted with this, and he created a state. That is a Palestinian state. It was made up of Palestinians, even though the leader, the person who was put on the throne, was from Saudi Arabia, was a Hashemite king.
You actually have an interesting phrase in there. You say that Churchill took away 4/5 of the territory of what was considered Palestine, under the Ottomans, I guess. And then he made it Judenrein, which is obviously the German word for absent of Jews. So what happened there? And Churchill sounded like he was a little proud of it. What was the story there?
Well, he was under pressure. The British were under pressure. What the historians know of this period know is that the original idea was when the Hashemites in what is now called Saudi Arabia helped the British and fought against the Turks during World War II, that royal family was promised to be set up in Syria and Iraq. And so Faisal, the son of Sharif Hussein, notably pictured in the movie Lawrence of Arabia, was promised the throne in Damascus. He was set up there, but the French objected, and the French and the British had their dispute over who was going to run around Syria, and the French Faisal out of Damascus. So as a consolation prize, he was given Baghdad, given what was Iraq, what became Iraq, which was borders were also drawn artificially. And so Faisal's brother, Abdullah, who's the father of King Hussein, was then given another consolation prize and set up on the throne in Amman, Jordan. And that area was called the Emirate of Transjordan. And the point of all this, of mentioning all this, is that it cut off a huge part of the territory through which the British had hoped to solve this problem. If there was more territory, I saw in a quote from Yeats referring to the conflict in Ireland, where he said, little land and much anger, or something like that, maimed us from the start. In other words, it's one thing to have a dispute with a lot of territory to try to solve the dispute, but when that territory is shrunken and shrunken, as it was in this case, and the dispute, you know, it's harder to solve the dispute, or at least the British found it harder to solve it. So the point is that the idea that somehow the Zionists came to the area we call, at that time called Palestine, and prevented the Arabs from having their own state, it's just a historical myth. It's a big lie. But it's a lie that continues to be spread, and it's very much part of current Palestinians. That is the real tragedy. It's part of the current Palestinians' leadership's new myth and their explanation of what happened in 1948.
So I think we all have been better off if the British hadn't given out inducements like they were Halloween candy, I guess.
Yes.
There's a story in a book that a book that I really enjoyed by Mike McCoskey. It's called Churchill's Promised Land, Zionism and Statecraft. And he tells about Churchill's visit to what was then Palestine, and Lawrence of Arabia shows him around, and he takes him to a rally of Arabs, and the Arabs are chanting, and Churchill thinks it's for him, and he's very gratified. He did have a big ego, and according to the book, he neglected to get a translation from T.E. Lawrence of what they were saying, and apparently what they were saying was, death to the Jews, slit their throats. So as you say, that's been going on for a long time.
Well, that's why I think my title, Jew Hatred, Rejectionism and Jew Hatred, they're part of both sides of the same coin. Why it's justified. I use a number of other illustrations that the various riots that broke out in Palestine, the Nebi Musa riots as early as 1919.
Yeah, talk about some of those riots or pogroms, as they were called.
Well,
there were multiple. They happened a couple of times, right?
At least three major periods before the creation of the State of Israel. And that was 1919, the Nebi Musa riots. No, it was in the early 20s. I'm sorry. The early 20s and the Nebi Musa riots, which during the holiday of Nebi Musa, Arabs gathered in the streets and went rampaging through the Jewish quarter and screaming, you know, kill the Jews. In fact, they did kill a number of Jews. And then again in 1929 in Hebron and in the city of Safed in the north, the same thing. And that those riots stirred up by the Grand Mufti, Haji Amin al-Husseini. Again, you know, kill the Jews. And in fact, the Jews of Hebron, which is one of the oldest Jewish settlements, going back hundreds of years, all of the Jews had to be evacuated. It was mostly a very, very religious community of pious Jews that had to be evacuated because of the riots, and it happened in Safed in the north also. And then during what's called the Arab Revolt, or the Palestinian Arab Revolt, for two or three years, which was a revolt against primarily the British, and it was very well organized, and it was guerrilla, you know, a guerrilla warfare sponsored by, promoted by the Grand Mufti. And as a result, when the revolt was put down, the Grand Mufti escaped out of Palestine. The British were after him. He wound up first in Lebanon and then eventually in Iraq. During that Arab revolt, of course, the Arabs also attacked Jewish settlements as part of their attempt to end the mandate and create an independent state and basically to get rid of the Jews.
You've mentioned this guy, the Grand Mufti, a couple of times, the Haji Amin al-Husseini. He was, I guess, appointed by the British, but he ended up being paid by the Nazis 50,000 marks a month, which is, I just figured out, double what Rommel was getting paid. And I think Rommel was probably more valuable to the German cause than Husseini. But who was this guy? Apparently a Jewish person, Herbert Samuel, made the pick. Could they have picked somebody else? Were there alternatives? Could they have picked some
Herbert Samuel,
moderate
Muslim? Well, he didn't have a record, yes. He was from one of the Husseini family. It's a very notable Palestinian Arab family. It goes back many, many years and still exists, you know, in the tradition of families and tribes. And he was a leader, and he was not himself a Qadi or anything like that. But he was chosen by Samuel, and the idea was he thought that this way, the Grand Mufti appointed to basically run the religious institutions, the head of the religious institutions in the Holy City, the Muslim religious institutions. Eventually, he then expanded his power, was made the head of a WASP. It's the institution that the Muslim institution in Palestine that gave out basically operated this kind of social welfare system for the Muslim community, and that gave him a tremendous base of power. And eventually, the Arabs during the revolt created a committee, representing their point of view, their interests. It was called the Arab Higher Committee, and it was basically there. And the Mufti was elected by the members of that committee as the head of the committee. So he was, actually in 1948, of course, it was suspended during the revolt and during World War II, and then it was recreated. They had a meeting in Gaza in 1947-48. Knowing that Haji Amin had spent the war years in Berlin, and as an ally of Hitler, he was nevertheless still elected as head of the Arab Higher Committee. And as the head of the Arab Higher Committee, he was from Cairo. To some degree, he directed the Palestinian part of the war against the Jewish community, what's called the Yishuv, the Jewish community in Palestine, before the creation of the State of Israel. Eventually, five Arab armies got involved. As soon as the British pulled out in May of 1948, Israel was established. David Ben-Gurion proclaimed independence on May 14th, 1948. Immediately, five Arab armies in invaded to try to crush the Jewish state in its infancy. But prior to that, for 6 months, there was a kind of civil war in the area of Jewish settlement. There were a volunteer army of Palestinians and some volunteers from some of the Arab countries. And Hashim al-Husseini basically ran the Palestinian Arab army that attacked Jewish settlements and tried to grab pieces of territory, anticipating a full invasion by the five Arab states.
You know, reading your book and listening to you, obviously you're sympathetic to the Israeli perspective on things, but there's another argument that you make in the book that I think is interesting, that from the Palestinian perspective, the policies that they've pursued have been disastrous. You talk about how Jewish immigration raised the Arab standard of living, but that didn't matter to their objections. You talk about how terror tactics seem to hurt the Arabs the most back in the 20s and 30s, and that not for the first time, it continues to be the case. And you talk about 650,000 Palestinian refugees from the 48 war, who you said have been subjected to 6 decades of welfare and indulgence, are now up to 4 million and have not seen any real improvements in their lifetime and in their standards of living or in their prospects. So talk about it from the Palestinian perspective a little bit.
Yes, that's a very important point that a lot of people seem to forget, since the focus is on the conflict between Palestinian Arabs and Israeli Jews, or Jews in Yishuv before 48, and the damage it's done to the Jews, which is quite a bit, 6,000 Israelis lost their lives during the War of Independence. That out of a total population of a little more than 600,000, that would have been the equivalent for, let's say, the United States in a war of over 2 million dead, which is just astronomical. So,
which is larger than the sum of all American dead in all American wars.
Yeah, right. So this was, I think I meant to say, did I say, I think 20,000 Israelis lost their lives in that war.
In the book you say 6,000 Israeli dead, equivalent to 1 million in the U.S.
Right,
now,
right.
1 million is a little less than the Americans
right.
died in every war. If it's 2 million, it's
right,
more
okay.
than the Americans have died in every war.
Okay, thanks.
I was taking careful notes when I read the book.
Yes, very good. But as you say, there was also tremendous damage to the Palestinians as human beings and as a people. I recognize they're right. I don't agree with Newt Gingrich that the Palestinians are an invented people any more than many other nationalities. There's always a kind of artificiality. I mean, Iraq was created by the British in the same way that Palestine or the territory of Transjordan. So I think they're entitled to independence. But the damage that was done to their own cause is just immense. First of all, the tremendous destruction during the Arab Revolt, when the British had offered them a state, essentially, and they turned it down. And they were offered a state in 1947, 48 by the United Nations, or a resolution included provision for a state. They rejected it completely and decided to go to war again and again at Camp David. Ehud Barak, Prime Minister of Israel, and Bill Clinton offered them a state. They rejected it. Few years ago, Prime Minister.
What were the parameters of that state? You know, it seemed that was a pretty generous deal for the Palestinians, if I recall. But can you talk a little bit about what happened there?
Well, you could argue that the argument is made sometimes that it wasn't all the territory that was there before the Six-Day War. It wasn't all of the West Bank. But there were provisions, exactly what Obama proposed earlier this year, the 6-day borders with swaps. In other words, to compensate for the fact that the Jewish settlement, the large settlement box, had been built on what was previously Arab territory before 67, the Arabs, the Palestinian Arabs, would get swaths of what was formerly part of Israel, along in the Negev, in north of Jerusalem. And Ehud Olmert, as I reported, in City Journal and elsewhere, in September of 2008, sat down with Mahmoud Abbas and in his home in Jerusalem and put a map on the table and showed him exactly where there would be a Palestinian state and what the borders would be, including all of Gaza and a passage which would be controlled by the Palestinians from Gaza to the West Bank. And the total land that was offered was pretty much the equivalent of 100% of what the Palestinians had before. I say Palestinians had, but of course that's a misnomer also, because the irony of all this, with all the talk about, Israel preventing the creation of a Palestinian state, is that Gaza and the West Bank, the totality of the West Bank, was under the control of Arabs for almost 20 years, from 1948 to 1967. The West Bank under the control of King of Jordan, King Hussein, and Gaza under the control of Egypt.
And you say in the book that the Palestinians were not very treated very well under the control of Egypt, right?
It was a police state, as there is police. There were police states in Egypt and in Jordan, but in particular, they tried to control Palestinian nationalism. The Egyptians in Gaza and King Hussein in on the West Bank controlled it in a sense of directed entirely against the Israelis. So there was a Palestinian Liberation Organization Arafat had started during that period, but it was totally under the control of the Egyptians, and there were terrorist attacks on Israel from Gaza and from the West Bank, but there was not any inclination of creating a Palestinian state, which could have easily been done, and nobody in Israel would not have opposed it in any way. It certainly wasn't the policy of the Israeli government before the Six-Day War to expand. It only did so after the war. So all of this, when you put all of this together, and plus the point you made, the 650,000 refugees, which is the only refugee problem in the world that has gone on for more than half a century, you see the suffering of the Palestinians as a result of this, with the cession against the Jews. That is, they seem to want, I agree, I accept the fact they want their own state. I don't doubt that when Mahmoud Abbas says we want our state, we deserve it, whatever you want. But apparently, when you put all of this together, apparently the Palestinians, as much as they want our state, they want to get rid of the Israeli state, the state of Israel, and a place for Jews in the Middle East. They want that much more, because that's the way they behave.
What's going on here? Is this a failure of leadership? I mean, is it Arafat is intractable, and that's why they can't do it? Or is it the Palestinian people more broadly are unwilling to take yes for an answer? The famous Abba Yair line about they won't take yes for an answer. Arafat said after Camp David that he wouldn't accept the deal because he was afraid he would be killed. So is it the leaders or is it the people?
Well, that's a very, very good question, and it's a little bit, and one, it's hard to disentangle the two. So one wants to say, as you pointed out, you just pointed out with Arafat and as well with Abbas, for example, take the issue of the right of return. Everyone knows that this is a deal killer. And when the Palestinians say they want the return, the right of return for their refugees, which are now, they claim, on the United Nations now recognizes 4 million refugees. Obviously, no Israeli government can accept that. And if that's not part of the peace deal, with the Palestinians finally accepting the reality that their refugees will have to be settled elsewhere and not in Israel, it will be settled in the West Bank and Lebanon and maybe Jordan. And the refusal to accept that is a deal killer. So the question is, why doesn't a visionary Palestinian leader, just as we want the Israeli leaders, and we had pressure on the Israeli leaders to accept the reality of a Palestinian state over the last 30 years. Initially, Golda Meir, you know, unfortunately said there are no Palestinians, and there was this idea we could Israel could return the West Bank, but only to Jordan. Israelis came to understand that this was not the Israeli leadership. This was not workable, that we had to accept the idea of a Palestinian state. Similarly, the question is, why wasn't there some visionary Palestinian leader to say to his countrymen, look, we've cheated you in effect. We've let you, and say it to the refugees, we've been lying to you for 60 years. As long as the conflict goes on, you will not go back unless you still dream of the idea of destroying Israel. And that's not likely, that's not a good prospect. And to accept that reality. So the question is, why haven't they done that? I sometimes argued, well, just as you pointed out, they're afraid there'll be any Palestinian leader who says that is likely to be assassinated. Now, is that because the people believe that, or is that because the leadership hasn't been courageous to educate their own people? I mean, the role of leadership is partly to change their own people's perspectives, bring some sense of reality. So it's both. The answer to your question is very complicated. It's sort of both. Each interacts with each other. Palestinian leadership's failure to educate their own people, and the people's obsession with anti-Jewish propaganda and the belief that the Jews have really no rights in the Middle East, which then prevents the leadership from making the concession, this concession, which is the key to reaching any kind of a deal.
Yeah, I have a slight disagreement with you when you said the question is, why haven't they done so? I mean, why haven't they agreed to a deal in the past? I don't think that's the question. The question is, what are the prospects for them doing so in the future? What do you think going forward are the chances of the Palestinians kind of changing their perspective and saying, okay, we're going to come to a deal. It's not going to be everything we want. It's not going to be everything the Israelis want, but that's what negotiation is all about.
Good point. That is the more important part of it. Except that, you know, how do you answer that question without going back into the past or in the most recent past? So far, what we see is, rather than accepting that idea that there's no possibility of the refugees going back, the leaders do seem to encourage it, rather than so that you now have every year during the Israeli celebration of the Israeli independence, the same day, it now becomes for the Palestinians what they call a kind of day of mourning. It's called their Nakba Day. Nakba is the Arabic word for catastrophe, and that's their catastrophe. They're focused and encouraged by the leadership to focus on 1948 instead of to solve the problem of the 1967 war. And unfortunately, Mahmoud Abbas is very much part of that. And as I point out in this broadside, in May of this past year, he wrote an op-ed piece for the New York Times. It was just filled with lies, claiming that for no cause at all, the Jews in 1948 just expelled the Arabs from their homes and created this refugee problem. If that's the way you describe the conflict with your own people, and that's right now, it's happened during this year, then my answer to you is no. There is no prospect. I don't see any evidence so far that they're willing to reconsider their position on the right of return.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned the Abbas piece, because you use I think an interesting device in terms of opening the book with this Abbas op-ed, and closing with it as well. And you said it's filled with lies. In the book, you're a little more politic. You said that the New York Times didn't fact-check it. But either way, the point is the same. Talk about the Abbas op-ed and why it's so important in telling us where the Palestinians are right now, and why you think it's unlikely that they'll come to an answer.
Yeah, I think that op-ed is crucial for many reasons, including the attitude of the Times. But I mean, it was published in the middle of May. It was around the time of the Nakba, and basically stated the Palestinian belief about 1948. Instead of talking about 1967, he had this opportunity in the op-ed and access in the New York Times. He talked about 1948. He lied about, he was born in Safed. I remember I mentioned one of the big riots in 1929, where lots of Jews were killed, was in the city of Safed, as it's called in Hebrew, in Safed. It's in the Galilee. It was a mixed Arab-Jewish town. The Arabs outnumbered the Jews. And in 1948, early in 1948, the Arabs of, there were volunteers from the Arab Liberation Army, the group that was controlled by the Mufti, came into Safed, and they attacked the Jewish quarter. And this time, it was a military battle. It wasn't just a rampage, because the Jews were armed. The Haganah was defending it. And the Jews, to make a long story short, the Jews fought back, and the Arabs left. I don't say every single Arab left because he wanted to leave. I'm not sure exactly, but by and large, reporters on the scene said the Arabs just fled once they lost the battle. And he was Nachman Abbas was 13 years old. But the way he describes it in the op-ed is, I was made a refugee and had to walk across the border into Syria, and I was living in a camp, in a tent. The New York Times put an illustration of a poor boy standing outside his tent, gazing at the verdant hills of Galilee and on the horizon. And this is a complete lie. The people, reporters, including I.F. Stone, a kind of a hero of the left, who was a reporter in Israel in 1948, pointed out that the Arabs fled because the Jews conquered the town. And as a matter of fact, Mahmoud Abbas didn't grow up as a refugee. He had family, had money. He was educated at Damascus, in Damascus, eventually in Moscow. But he's used the occasion to create this myth of the only reason that Arabs fled was because the Jews pushed them out. There's no discussion, even a concession that maybe both sides were wrong. We were fighting over this territory, and now it's time to settle the difference. No attempt to say, look, we know if Israelis have to give up claims over the West Bank, we have to give up our claim on the right of return of 4 billion refugees, which we know is impossible. So that's why that one piece is really symptomatic of what's the problem. What's the heart of the problem in this conflict between Palestine and Israel?
Well, now that we've gotten to the heart of the problem, and you've been very generous with your time, which I appreciate, let me ask you our signature question here on New Books in Public Policy, which is, if you were czar of the U.S. for a day, what policies would you institute that would help solve this intractable problem?
I think that the president should seize the bully pulpit and say what has to be said on the other side. He has said what has to be said. I don't, that Israel has to accept the fact that it's going to give up most of the territory it occupied during the Six-Day War in Gaza and the West Bank. It already has in Gaza. It's completely, that's an independent little Palestinian state, and we see what happened. But he's right. But he also has to stand up and say, look, Palestinians have to accept the reality that there will be no right of return. Once we start from those two premises, it's a question of deciding and accept the idea of a permanent peace and give up the idea that they're going to reverse what happened in 48. That this is a negotiation about the consequences of 67, not the 48 war. If the president said that, it would very, very helpful. The fact that he hasn't said it is very, very disappointing, and shows that, in my view, that he has a distorted view of the conflict.
Well, very interesting suggestion and very interesting book. Saul Stern, thank you for taking the time to join us here today on New Books in Public Policy.
Thank you, Teddy. Great fun.
Thank you for listening to the interview with Saul Stern and his book, A Century of Palestinian Projectionism and True Hatred, part of the Encounter Broadside series. And in the book and in the interview, Saul talks about the problems of the Palestinian approach to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, why it's unlikely to solve the current problems, but also why is it not only problematic from the Israeli perspective, but why it's harmful to the Palestinians. I hope you enjoyed listening to the interview. I hope you check out the Encounter Broadside. And as always, this is Tevi Troy signing off and saying, keep reading.